des moments où ça va pas bien. Mais tu sais, si c'est vraiment, ça vous cause un dysfonctionnement, que vous êtes plus capable de sortir de chez vous, que vous avez envie de frapper dans le mur à chaque fois que, je sais pas moi, vous entendez un bruit qui vous fait penser à ce trauma-là, ben là, c'est problématique. Là, c'est la différence entre un stress post-traumatique puis quelqu'un qui vit un trauma, qui a peut-être pas envie d'en parler pendant 2 heures tous les soirs, mais qui est capable de continuer de vivre, là.
Tout à l'heure, tu m'as parlé pour le stress post-traumatique de propranolol. J'ai entendu parler du prazosin aussi pour soigner ça. C'est un peu bizarre. C'est pas des médicaments qu'on utilise habituellement en psychiatrie ou dans l'anxiété. Peux-tu m'expliquer pourquoi est-ce qu'on utilise des médicaments de ces catégories-là?
C'est un peu, dans le fond, le stress post-traumatique, c'est comme si notre boucle noradrénergique de notre cerveau reptilien, là, pas le cortex, là, mais ce qui est plus enfoui dans notre cerveau, notre boucle noradrénergique continuait de lancer des influx noradrénergiques constants pour qu'on soit en hypervigilance, puis pour, au fond, faire en sorte qu'on ne se retrouve pas dans une autre situation traumatisante. Hein. Fait que c'est un peu ça que notre cerveau fait, mais notre cerveau continue à envoyer des signaux de détresse et d'alarme alors que on n'est plus dans le trauma. Donc, c'est ça qui est pathologique. Fait que ces molécules-là vont jouer sur, par exemple, les récepteurs alpha. Le prazosin, c'est alpha 1 adrénergique. Ça va au SNC, puis ça fait en sorte d'aider les troubles du sommeil, d'aider le traitement cognitif du stress par le cortex préfrontal. Ça vient comme bloquer un peu cette hyperfonction noradrénergique-là.
Puis est-ce que les gens vont prendre ça à vie ou c'est durant un épisode en particulier puis qui peuvent soigner?
Le stress post-traumatique, si on a un traumatisme d'un certain niveau, puis on a vraiment des bons symptômes, ça prend une psychothérapie pour adresser ça. Donc, les médicaments vont, mettons, le prazosin va faire en sorte qu'on va continuer à avoir des rêves, mais pas nécessairement tous des cauchemars reliés au trauma parce que ça fait un certain cercle vicieux. Le patient est fatigué, il est stressé toute la journée, il finit par s'endormir, il fait des cauchemars qui lui refont penser au trauma. C'est ultra stressant, t'as plus envie de dormir, mais t'es fatigué, donc ça rend tout l'état de la personne encore pire. Donc, ce qu'on va faire en psychothérapie, c'est qu'on va désensibiliser la personne à ça, ou on va, tu sais, dans un lien thérapeutique, on va revivre des moments du trauma, puis essayer de faire en sorte que le cortex préfrontal, ou tu sais, que notre cortex, que notre cerveau plus intellectuel, défasse des choses par rapport à ça et traite l'information et réalise qu'au fond, qu'on n'est plus dans le trauma, là, qu'on n'est plus dans une situation, stressante.
Ben, tu parles de situation stressante, là. On dirait que notre réflexe dans ce temps-là, c'est de donner des benzodiazépines, là, quand on est dans une phase aiguë. Puis là, tu m'as dit tout à l'heure que ça marchait pas, en fait, que ça empirait les choses. As-tu bien
Ouais,
compris?
la plupart des données sont négatives. Les risques sont plus grands que les bénéfices. Tu sais, c'est vraiment du très, très court terme. Et mettons, le stress post-traumatique, on a découvert que, mettons, tu es avec ton conjoint, ta conjointe, tu conduis, tu fais un accident, ton conjoint, ta conjointe décède sous tes yeux. Si je te donne une benzo pour t'aider à passer à travers les prochaines semaines, je vais pas diminuer ton risque de stress post-traumatique, je vais même potentiellement l'augmenter. Tu sais, c'est parce que ça change ton architecture de sommeil, ça change la façon dont ton cerveau va traiter l'information. C'est pas utile. Puis l'extrême majorité des patients vont devenir dépendants de ça. Puis l'effet des benzos sur l'architecture du sommeil, dans le fond, ça va pas faire en sorte qu'on va moins avoir de cauchemars, moins rêver ou mieux dormir. Ça va être plutôt le contraire. Donc, c'est vraiment pas souhaitable.
Donc, quand on anticipe qu'un patient pourrait développer un choc post-traumatique des suites d'un événement là, important qu'il a subi, on devrait choisir d'autres choses pour traiter la phase aiguë, là, où est-ce qu'il nous consulte parce qu'il se sent très anxieux. Qu'est-ce que tu proposes?
Ouais, c'est ça. Il n'y a pas grand-chose. Honnêtement, il n'y a pas grand-chose qui est démontré, tu sais, en phase aiguë après ça qui est efficace. Puis toutes les mesures qu'on pensait qui étaient bonnes, là, comme tu sais, de faire des debriefings, puis d'aller s'asseoir avec un psychologue, puis d'en parler plusieurs fois, c'est pas nécessairement bon. Mais après quelques semaines, je pense que quand la personne, tu sais, veut en parler, puis a digéré un peu ça, là, oui, ça peut être adéquat, là. Puis là, oui, si la personne a un niveau de symptômes de stress post-traumatique, ça peut être adéquat de donner un médicament. Mais honnêtement, tu sais, je sais que on est des pharmaciens là, faut comme résister à l'envie de donner quelque chose pour aider la personne à passer à travers ça, ça va pas l'aider, même ça va lui nuire, tu sais.
Donc, par exemple, le zopiclone, le trazodone, ces choses-là, ce n'est pas nécessairement les meilleures alternatives, là.
Non plus, non. Il y a des molécules que je peux pas dire qu'il y a d'études en aigu qui dit que ça nuit, là. Fait que, tu sais, si on veut vraiment donner quelque chose, mais honnêtement, je pense pas que ça va tant aider. C'est un peu comme normal de pas bien dormir, puis c'est un peu normal de, tu sais, c'est plate à dire, là, mais c'est comme une réaction normale. Tout comme quand quelqu'un vit un deuil, c'est pas toujours une pathologie. Tu sais, je comprends que des fois, on veut dire peut-être que la personne est en train de faire une dépression, mais c'est comme une réaction un peu normale. Donc, on peut pas tout enlever, les émotions négatives reliées à des choses, des gros événements majeurs. Il faut comme attendre un peu, puis voir après ça qu'est-ce qui se développe puis qu'est-ce qui reste. Ce qui veut dire, par contre, là, que quelqu'un qui a déjà fait un stress post-traumatique, qui a déjà fait une dépression majeure, on n'attendra peut-être pas de le voir pas bien aller pendant un mois dans son coin sans rien faire non plus. Là, t'sais, on peut commencer un traitement d'entretien un peu plus tôt que ça. Mais je veux dire, il n'y a comme rien à faire au jour 1 qui est prouvé, genre très, très efficace et tout ça qui va permettre à la personne de sauver un peu de la réaction normale à l'événement traumatisant ou stressant, là.
OK, c'est plus clair. J'ai l'impression de changer un peu de sujet, mais j'aimerais absolument aborder le trouble obsessif compulsif. Ouais. Parce que pour moi, c'est comme une entité un peu à part des autres. Là. Je ne sais pas si tu peux m'aider à me démêler. Là. C'est quoi la différence entre une obsession et une compulsion? Tu en as parlé un petit peu au début, là, mais juste pour que ce soit bien clair.
Bon, ben, l'obsession, c'est ça va être des pensées. En fait, l'extrême majorité, c'est des pensées, mais des fois, ça peut être des impulsions ou des images que la personne va avoir. Donc, généralement, c'est désagréable. Là. Donc, ça peut être des images de choses dégoûtantes ou tout ça qui nous reviennent comme un peu en tête, là, des espèces de dépressions, ou ça peut être des pensées tout à fait rationnelles, du genre j'ai peur que je mette le feu à la maison ou j'ai peur d'attraper tel virus. Là. Puis la personne va essayer de ne pas tenir compte de cette obsession-là par des compulsions, qui sont des comportements répétitifs, des espèces de rituels ou des actes mentaux répétés, genre compter 8 fois ou pas marcher sur les cracks de trottoir ou tout ça, ou prier, compter ou passer absolument à la droite des personnes qu'on croise pour essayer de diminuer ces obsessions-là. Les personnes, la plupart du temps dans le TOC, sont conscientes du caractère un peu futile de ça. T'sais, la personne sait que, quand bien même qu'elle vérifierait 8 fois que le four est fermé ou que la porte est barrée, il vérifie une ou deux fois, ça aurait été assez, mais elle a comme besoin de le faire un certain nombre de fois parce qu'elle considère que si elle ne le fait pas ce nombre de fois-là, son anxiété monte trop et son obsession prend trop de place.
C'est particulier, hein? Puis dans les soins, moi, j'avais appris qu'il fallait utiliser des doses élevées, pour des doses d'antidépresseurs élevées. Mais ça fait un peu peur d'utiliser des doses élevées. C'est quoi les doses élevées pour toi? Est-ce que c'est comme les doses maximales qu'on voit dans le compendium ou plus encore?
Ouais, c'est ça. Bien, je dirais que si on regarde certaines lignes directrices qui ont regardé les données, c'est plus aussi clair qu'il faut absolument pour avoir la dose max. Par contre, c'est un trouble qui est plus souvent résistant. Il y a beaucoup de patients qui voient une différence dans le dernier 10-20% d'augmentation de dose. C'est que je pense que ça vaut la peine pour plusieurs troubles anxieux, mais surtout pour ce trouble-là, de pas juste viser la dose minimale efficace, mais quand on titre la molécule, de viser la dose maximale tolérée. De toute façon, l'efficacité va être longue avant d'arriver. Si elle arrive, t'sais, on ne fait pas viser une dose d'antidépresseur comme en dépression. On vise à peu près la dose max tolérée ou la dose max selon la fonction rénale, les interactions que le patient présente. Puis oui, moi, je suis assez vieille pour avoir connu du citalopram 80 mg. Là, si on regarde les premières études, c'était donné même en dépression, tout ça, puis les patients sont pas morts. Là. Je veux dire, je comprends qu'il y a le QT aussi. Je ne dis pas d'utiliser des doses au-delà de la monographie pour ça. Il y a une implication médico-légale à le faire, mais je pense que c'est correct d'aller à la dose maximale de la monographie pour le patient moyen qui le tolère. Puis après ça, de regarder si ça fonctionne, puis si ça fonctionne, puis s'il y a des effets secondaires, bien là, après ça, on peut essayer de diminuer un tout petit peu la dose. Mais le problème, si on fait juste viser une dose minimale ou une dose moyenne, c'est que ça va nous prendre six mois à essayer une molécule, puis tu sais, on n'aura même pas essayé la molécule jusqu'au bout. C'est pour ça que oui, on vise la dose maximale tolérée, puis ce qui peut souvent être la dose maximale monographie. Dans quelques rares cas, des fois, on pourrait dépasser la dose maximale, mais c'est sûr que je le recommande pas, là. Mais ça peut arriver qu'il y ait des patients qui essaient ça, puis si on a essayé de diminuer, tu sais, il faut vraiment documenter au dossier qu'après ça, on a essayé de diminuer un petit peu la dose, puis que là, le patient a rechuté ou allait vraiment pas bien, là. Je pense que chez certains patients, ça peut être correct, mais il faut vraiment très, très bien le documenter, puis être sûr qu'ils le tolèrent, puis que ça les met pas à risque de d'autres problèmes, là.
Bien, ça m'amène un peu, j'aimerais ça revenir sur les troubles anxieux en général. Là, ben justement, celui-là, le trouble obsessif-compulsif, ça m'apparaît comme un trouble peut-être plus grave, mais quand même, mais est-ce que il y a des situations en trouble anxieux où est-ce qu'on devrait référer à l'urgence, là, ou si on peut toujours gérer ça dans la communauté, là, avec des suivis avec un médecin de famille, par exemple?
C'est rarement l'hospitalisation qui va être bénéfique. Il faut qu'il y ait vraiment un très, très gros problème de fonctionnement pour que le trouble anxieux ait besoin d'être hospitalisé. Parce que, un peu, d'une certaine façon, les patients vont d'eux-mêmes se retirer de tout ce qui déclenche leur anxiété puis s'isoler chez eux. Ce qui n'est pas nécessairement souhaitable pour la plupart des patients. Mais c'est sûr que si ça nuit au fonctionnement au point où la personne sort plus jamais de chez elle, ne mange plus, dépérit. Là, oui, ça peut être adéquat de la référer, mais comme il n'y a pas de traitement miracle non plus, c'est rarement une hospitalisation pour un trouble anxieux qui va être salutaire, mais ça peut l'être, là, si la personne a vraiment, vraiment des gros problèmes. Et je pense que ce qui est mieux, c'est plus d'appeler le 811, info sociale, de voir que la personne rencontre une travailleuse sociale ou un psychologue ou un médecin qui fait des ajustements à sa pharmacothérapie, qui identifie c'est quoi le problème. Déjà, ça va rassurer le patient puis son entourage, puis il y a plus de chances que ça s'améliore. Je pense que, t'sais, surtout ces temps-ci, personne n'a tant envie d'être à l'hôpital, là, surtout pour un trouble anxieux, là.
Est-ce qu'il faut,
Donc,
mais si on compare à d'autres maladies psychiatriques, là, est-ce qu'il faut penser au risque de suicide? Est-ce que c'est
Ben
plus prévalent?
oui, c'est possible, là. Oui, c'est le genre de choses à dépister, puis oui, c'est le genre de choses à savoir est-ce que la personne est quand même capable de s'occuper d'elle-même puis des personnes à sa charge, là, dans ce sens-là, oui. Mais c'est rare que ça nécessite nécessairement une hospitalisation. Mais oui, les gens peuvent être découragés de ça puis faire des tentatives de suicide. C'est le stress post-traumatique. La plupart des gens vont comme développer une toxicomanie, tu sais, d'alcool ou de benzo ou de toutes sortes d'affaires qu'ils vont essayer de prendre pour se geler puis éviter de penser à leur trauma puis être capable de dormir un peu, là. Fait que je pense qu'il y a toutes ces choses-là à côté qu'il faut s'assurer qu'ils sont d'une certaine façon sécuritaires, là.
OK. Écoute, c'était un survol, on s'entend, hein? Si on a encore des questions, là, puis qu'on veut se renseigner ou savoir qu'est-ce qui est les textes les plus importants, est-ce que tu pourrais me parler des références que tu utilises?
Il y a les lignes directrices canadiennes. C'est sûr qu'ils datent déjà de 2014, là, mais en fait, il n'y a pas tant d'autres lignes directrices qui sont vraiment meilleures, ben, ou en fait, pas pour toutes les troubles anxieux ensemble. Pour bien décrire c'est quoi chaque trouble, les premières, deuxième ligne, troisième ligne, les principes de traitement, etc., je pense que les lignes directrices canadiennes font encore un très bon tour.
Donc, est-ce que tu as un message clé, quelque chose à ajouter? Là, on a fait un survol, peut-être des choses qu'on n'a pas abordées que tu aimerais discuter pour le bénéfice de nos auditeurs?
Ouais, ben je veux juste tu sais, que les gens se souviennent qu'en trouble anxieux, la dose minimale efficace, ça peut marcher, là, mais souvent ça prend plus la dose maximale tolérée. Je pense que ça vaut la peine de continuer de titrer tant que le patient le tolère. Ça ne veut pas dire de titrer vite, hein, surtout en trouble panique. T'sais, on peut exacerber le patient au début si on titre trop vite notre ISRS, mais je pense que ça vaut la peine de continuer de titrer lentement puis de viser, t'sais, une dose tolérée, surtout que les effets secondaires, par exemple des ISRS, sont pas tant dose dépendants. Fait que je pense que ça vaut la peine, t'sais, de rassurer le patient puis d'avoir des attentes réalistes aussi sur quand est-ce que ça va faire effet. La psychothérapie devrait être offerte à tout le monde ou puis encouragée. Puis après ça, ben, je pense que pour les pharmaciens aussi, l'autre chose à savoir, c'est par rapport au sevrage des molécules, là. T'sais, on a comme des recettes un peu préétablies pour tout le monde, mais ça se peut, surtout chez les patients anxieux, que ça prenne des mois à sevrer les molécules. Puis c'est pas problématique, là. Je pense qu'il faut donner le bénéfice du doute au patient puis le croire, là, même si t'sais, on considère que 5 mg de citalopram, ça ne devrait pas faire une différence chez le patient, mais ça se peut très bien que notre patient devant nous, oui, ça fasse une différence, puis qu'il faut sevrer encore plus tranquillement, puis peut-être même faire des formes pharmaceutiques spéciales pour les entre-deux doses, là.
Bon, mais je te remercie, Violaine, d'avoir accepté notre invitation. Je suis content qu'on ait fait un survol là, des troubles anxieux.
Bien, merci de l'invitation. Je pense que ça concerne quand même vraiment beaucoup de gens, puis ça vaut la peine, comme pharmacien, de prendre le temps de s'asseoir avec le patient, d'avoir des attentes réalistes, puis des craintes réalistes aussi par rapport aux effets secondaires qui n'arrivent pas chez tout le monde, mais qui vont plus arriver chez nos anxieux qui ont peur que ça arrive. Fait que de déconstruire tous ces mythes-là et d'y aller tranquillement, c'est très possible d'avoir un bon contrôle de son anxiété.
Voici qui conclut cet épisode de Très Pharmacien. Au prochain épisode, votre animatrice habituelle sera de retour pour discuter des urgences hypertensives avec Marie-Ève Tourigny-Poirier du CHU de Québec, Université Laval. Alors, soyez des nôtres.
This is Democracy Now!
How many more generations of America's daughters and sons would you have me send to fight Afghanistan's civil war when Afghan troops will not?
As thousands of Afghans try to flee Afghanistan after the Taliban seize control, we'll look at the roots of the longest U.S. war in history. Nearly 20 years ago, the Bush administration rejected an offer from the Taliban to surrender.
If you're asking, would an arrangement with Omar where he could, quote, live in dignity in the Kandahar area or some place in Afghanistan be consistent with what I have said? The answer is no, it would not be consistent with what I have said.
We'll spend the hour with the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Spencer Ackerman, author of the new book, Reign of Terror, how the 9/11 era destabilized America and produced Trump.
Reign of Terror is a book about the devastating effects that America's 20-year war on terror after 9/11 had on American democracy. The ways in which the war on terror acted as a doorway to the most violent and nativist elements of American history.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Afghanistan, chaotic scenes continue to play out at Kabul airport as Afghans desperate to escape Taliban rule. Thousands of people have lined the perimeter of the airport, with Taliban soldiers using rifle butts, whips and sticks to beat back crowds. The White House says about 9,000 people have been evacuated from the airport since Sunday, when the Taliban swept through Kabul. U.S. Army Major General William Taylor said the Pentagon is temporarily increasing its presence to facilitate the evacuation.
The U.S. military footprint in Kabul is now more than 5,200 total troops on the ground. Kabul airport remains secure and open for flight operations. F-18s from the Ronald Reagan Carrier Strike Group flew armed overwatch flights over Kabul to ensure enhanced security.
President Biden is delivering a national address in Afghanistan today at 1 p.m. Eastern. Meanwhile, the Afghan Taliban says it's executed Abu Omar Khorasani, the imprisoned former head of the Islamic State in South Asia, shortly after it took control of Afghanistan. Khorasani's killing bolsters the Taliban's claims the group will not cooperate with Islamic State and that it views the group as an adversary. Afghanistan's sports federations identified one of at least two people who fell to their deaths from a U.S. military plane as it hastily evacuated Kabul airport Monday. 17-year-old Zaki Anwari was a member of Afghanistan's national youth soccer team. He was among dozens of people filmed running alongside a U.S. Air Force C-17 plane as it sped down a runway, some of them clinging to the plane's sides and landing gear. In Greece, hundreds of Afghan immigrants protested outside of Athens Thursday, demanding support from the international community and the European Union. Their protests came after Greece's migration minister warned Greece would not be a gateway for Afghan refugees.
I just heard that Greek government don't want any refugees more. But why? If, like, your own people should be at this situation, what you'll do? So they have to stand with refugees, and they have to stand with Afghan people, and they have to help them in this situation.
In Geneva, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees called for Afghanistan's neighbors to keep their borders open to allow asylum seekers to seek refuge abroad. The UN reports Taliban fighters are conducting door-to-door visits to the homes of Afghans who work with the U.S. and NATO forces. The World Health Organization's Africa director has condemned plans by the United States and other wealthy countries to offer third-dose COVID vaccine booster shots, while only 2% of Africa's 1.3 billion people have been fully vaccinated. Dr. Machidiso Moete said the U.S. should give priority to poorer nations.
Moves by some countries globally to introduce booster shots threaten the promise of a brighter tomorrow for Africa. As some richer countries hoard vaccines, they make a mockery, frankly, of vaccine equity.
U.S. coronavirus cases continue to climb, are now averaging more than 140,000 cases and over 900 deaths per day. Nearly 99% of U.S. infections are from the Delta coronavirus variant. In Pennsylvania, the Archdiocese of Philadelphia has become the latest Catholic Church body to reject religious exemptions to COVID-19 vaccine mandates. In Texas, the state Supreme Court Thursday sided with school districts that are defying the Republican Governor Greg Abbott's ban on mask mandates. The ruling will allow Houston area schools and several South Texas school districts to continue to require face coverings. Meanwhile, three fully vaccinated U.S. senators have tested positive for coronavirus. Maine Independent Senator Angus King, Colorado Democratic Senator John Hickenlooper, and Mississippi's Republican Roger Wicker all reported mild symptoms of COVID-19. Governor Abbott is also COVID positive. In Haiti, a major hospital in the capital, Port-au-Prince, shut its doors Thursday in protest after two of its doctors were kidnapped by criminal gangs. One of the doctors is an orthopedic surgeon who'd been treating survivors of Saturday's massive earthquake, which has left nearly 2,200 people dead and injured more than 12,000. The numbers are rising rapidly. On Thursday, humanitarian aid workers said shipments began flowing more quickly into Haiti's southwestern peninsula, but there are still shortages of urgently needed food and medical supplies. In Washington, D.C., police responding to a bomb threat arrested a North Carolina man Thursday, capping an hours-long standoff near the U.S. Capitol. 49-year-old Floyd Ray Roseberry parked his truck on the sidewalk outside the Library of Congress, claiming he had explosives and calling on all Democrats to step down. Roseberry's previous social media posts show he was an ardent Trump supporter. Meanwhile, Alabama Republican Congressmember Mo Brooks voiced support for Roseberry. Brooks said in a statement, quote, "I understand citizenry anger directed at dictatorial socialism," Brooks said. His statement drew condemnation from several lawmakers, including Virginia Congressmember Don Beyer, who tweeted, quote, "It is astonishing that this needs to be said, but no one who serves in Congress should be expressing public sympathy with the views of a terrorist who threatened to blow up the U.S. Capitol," unquote. Roseberry said he had enough explosives to blow 2.5 blocks around him and that other vehicles had explosives in them. None of that was true. The Texas House of Representatives reached a quorum Thursday for the first time since Democrats fled the state last month to block a voter suppression bill. Earlier this week, the Texas Supreme Court ruled the absent Democratic lawmakers could be arrested and forced to return to the Capitol in Austin. The Republican-led House is set to consider the voting bill during its special session called by Governor Abbott. The returning Democrats vowed to continue their fight from the House floor. A new report details how the U.S. government cracked down on racial justice activists as protests swept the country following the police murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor in 2020. The study was published by the Movement for Black Lives and the Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility Clinic. One of the report's authors said, quote, "The federalization of protest-related charges was a deliberate and cynical effort to target and discourage those who protested in defense of black lives." The Biden administration has revived an antitrust lawsuit against Facebook. On Thursday, the Federal Trade Commission asked a U.S. district court to force Facebook to divest from WhatsApp and Instagram, arguing the social media giant had erected a monopoly that illegally crushed its competition. In June, the same court threw out a lawsuit by the FTC, ruling it failed to provide enough evidence to make a case that Facebook operates a monopoly. The Biden administration announced it's canceling over $5.8 billion in federal student loan debt for over 300,000 people who have what is known as a total and permanent disability. Advocacy groups and progressive lawmakers welcome the news and renewed calls for Biden to use his executive authority to cancel the remaining $1.8 trillion in student debt for all borrowers. A warning to our audience, this story contains descriptions of sexual abuse. Here in New York, the trial for accused sexual predator R. Kelly is underway. The singer's personal physician testified Thursday. Kelly has had genital herpes since at least 2007, but potentially as early as 2000, as prosecutors say knowingly infected multiple people. Geronda Pace, a survivor, testified. The singer forced her to dress up as a Girl Scout, recorded their sexual activity, and that she had to ask for his permission to use the bathroom. Pace, who is now 28 but was just 16 at the time of the abuse, also said she contracted herpes from R. Kelly. The singer faces multiple federal criminal charges, including sexual exploitation of children, kidnapping, and forced labor. In climate news, rain fell instead of snow on Greenland's summit, which is nearly 2 miles above sea level for the first time on record. The rain came down Saturday as temperatures rose to above freezing for the third time in a decade during another major melt event. This comes as wildfires continue to rage around the world. Scientists say blazes in Siberia have produced 800 megatons of carbon dioxide since early June, nearly double a record set just last year. The fires have released as much carbon as Germany emits in an entire year. In California, 11,000 firefighters continue battle more than a dozen active fires, including the Dixie Fire, the largest single wildfire in California history, which remains just one-third contained. Meanwhile, government researchers say the historic drought covering much of the western U.S. is likely to last into the fall, if not longer. A new study this week found the number of deaths caused by extreme temperatures increased exponentially as the climate disaster has gotten worse. Between 1980 and 2016, deaths related to heat rose by 74%, while deaths caused by extreme cold increased by 31% since 1990. In Britain, activists with Extinction Rebellion blockaded an entrance to an ExxonMobil facility in Hampshire to protest against the expansion of an oil refinery. Activists were dressed as Grim Reapers, as well as an Exxon executive who pumped fake blood from an oil barrel.
I don't know what more to do to bring attention to this catastrophe that we're all heading for, not in this country, but all over the world. We're seeing it now. We're seeing the horrific weather conditions, heat, drought, wildfires everywhere. That's only going to get worse if we don't immediately get a grip on bringing down our emissions.
And in Pennsylvania, human rights advocates protested Thursday against a vote to reopen a controversial jail for immigrant families.
Shut down Burt!
The Berks County so-called residential center was closed in February when all of the immigrant families held there were freed. But Berks County commissioners voted Thursday to amend their contract with ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and turn Berks into an all-women immigration prison. One of those who spoke out against the vote was Adriana Zambrano with ALDEA, the People's Justice Center.
Detaining immigrant women is just as wrong, unnecessary, and dangerous as the detention of families. Immigrant detention in every way is also separation. Detention separates individuals from their families who are willing and able to take them into their home while their legal process moves along. It means separation from community, communities like ours, which are made better by the presence and by the investments of immigrants. Detention is also separation from access to critical services.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we spend the hour with the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Spencer Ackerman, author of the new book, Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. Stay with us.
To me. Oh, oh, I despise, 'cause it means destruction of innocent lives. War means tears, ten thousands of mothers die when their sons go out to fight and lose their lives. I said war, good God, y'all.
What is it good for?
Absolutely,
never.
Get said again.
War by Edwin Starr. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations is urging countries to keep their borders open with Afghanistan as thousands of Afghans try to flee by land or air after the Taliban seized control of the country Sunday ahead of the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Earlier this week, President Biden defended his decision to pull troops out as part of a deal the Trump administration made with the Taliban.
How many more generations of America's daughters and sons would you have me send to fight Afghanistan's civil war when Afghan troops will not? How many more lives, American lives, is it worth? How many endless rows of headstones at Arlington National Cemetery? I'm clear on my answer. I will not repeat the mistakes we've made in the past.
We turn now to look at the roots of what's become America's longest war. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan October 7, 2001, less than a month after the al-Qaeda attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Within days of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, the Taliban offered to hand over Osama bin Laden, the al-Qaeda leader. But the Bush administration rejected any negotiations with the Taliban. This is Bush's press secretary, Ari Fleischer, responding to a question in October 2001.
Would you go so far as to say that no matter what the Taliban might say at this point, it may not make any difference? Are you ignoring whatever they may say?
The president could not have made it any clearer 2 weeks ago when he said that there will be no discussions and no negotiations. So what they say is not as important as what they do. And it's time for them to act. It's been time for them to act.
In December of 2001, just a month or two later, the Taliban offered to surrender control of Kandahar if its leader, Mullah Mohammed Omar, would be allowed to, quote, live in dignity in opposition custody. U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld rejected the offer.
If you're asking, would an arrangement with Omar where he could, quote, live in dignity in the Kandahar area or some place in Afghanistan be consistent with what I have said? The answer is no, it would not be consistent with what I have said.
That's Donald Rumsfeld speaking December 6, 2001. The U.S. war in Afghanistan would continue for almost 20 more years through to now. According to the Cost of War Project, the U.S. has spent over $2.2 trillion in Afghanistan and Pakistan. By one count, at least 71,000 Afghan and Pakistani civilians have died in the fighting. Afghanistan is now facing a massive humanitarian crisis, and the Taliban is back in power. While Mullah Mohammed Omar died in 2013, his brother-in-law, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, now appears set to become Afghanistan's next president. Well, today we're spending the hour with the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Spencer Ackerman, author of the new book, Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. The book is based in part on his reporting from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo. Spencer, it's great to have you back. Congratulations on your book. So we're talking to you in the midst of this chaos in Kabul right now as thousands of Afghans, Americans, and other nationals are attempting to flee Afghanistan. The Taliban have taken over. But we chose to begin back 20 years ago. I'm not going to say at the beginning, because it goes far back from there. But talk about this moment as the U.S. began bombing and occupying Afghanistan, when the Taliban basically said they would surrender and also give Osama bin Laden over. The U.S. rejected. President Bush rejected both.
This was a central aspect of the war on terror at its inception and a foreshadowing of what its implications would be. Once we accept the frame that Bush offered, war on terror, we were then locked into a struggle not just against al-Qaeda, the entity culpable for the 9/11 attacks, but a much broader struggle against an enemy that a president could redefine at will and leave in the popular imagination was something along the lines of a civilizational challenge to America for the future, one in which America itself was in the balance. Now, let's look in particular at that moment in Kandahar. The United States' Northern Alliance allies had routed the Taliban from Kabul. The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan had fallen after about 5-6 years in power. And they recognized, after a last stand they tried to put on in Kandahar didn't go the way they expected, that the end was near for them. And then they offered to Hamid Karzai, the U.S.'s appointed leader for a post-Taliban Afghanistan, that as long as Mullah Omar could live in some kind of house arrest, basically, you know, not be killed, not be, you know, put up on trial, they were prepared to entertain negotiations for what their role might be in a post-Taliban Afghanistan, basically a political settlement at that point. Karzai, for all his flaws that the United States would both contribute to and then criticize him for over the coming years, nevertheless knew Afghan history and recognized that unless there was some kind of political future for the Taliban would opt for a violent future. And they had a proven capacity not just to wage an insurgency, but to triumph in one. And Karzai took the deal. It was the Bush administration, the United States, that said such a deal was unacceptable, not to the Afghans, but unacceptable to the United States, that now took it on itself, as it has so often, throughout its history in so many parts of the world to tell Afghans the way their country was about to be. And everything that happened since, the 20 years of war since, has contributed on, if not quite a straight line, a kind of, you know, nausea-inducing glide path to the abject horror we're seeing at the Kabul airport, with people desperate to flee, so desperate as to grab onto C-17 cargo planes and fall to their deaths. This is not the alternative to fighting in Afghanistan. This is the results of fighting in Afghanistan.
So if you could take it back even farther to the U.S.-backed Mujahideen, to the U.S.-backed mm-hmm. Osama bin Laden, and talk about what happened when the U.S. decided to fund the Mujahideen in fighting against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, and then the Mujahideen setting literally their gun sights, their U.S. weapons, on the United States, and how the Taliban came out of that.
Yeah, it's important because, like, an objection to this is always going to be that we, you know, portrayed, like, the, you know, 1980s Afghan Mujahideen as the Taliban. They weren't the Taliban. They were the precursors of the Taliban. What happened in the 1980s is the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and the United States saw an opportunity. It saw an opportunity to inflict upon the Soviet Union, its great geopolitical adversary, a defeat as humiliating and as psychologically devastating as the one the United States suffered in Vietnam for its own imperial hubris. Over the course of the next 10 years, the United States, the Pakistani ISI, and the Saudi intelligence services funded and equipped Islamic extremists, rebels who would come in from Pakistan, among them a figure who would become intimately familiar as a Taliban ally, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a particularly brutal person. And over the course of the 1980s, they inflicted tremendous damage on the Soviets, made the occupation, which was a brutal occupation by the Soviet Union, ever more violent and ever more protracted, to the point where the Soviets withdrew, and a couple of years later, the regime the Soviets installed collapsed, much as like we're seeing the one that the United States installed collapsed. The ensuing chaos and civil war was devastating for Afghanistan. Out of the ashes emerged the Taliban, an extreme group, a group that, you know, used mechanisms of extreme suffering and repression on the long-suffering Afghan people, and something that the United States never recognized throughout this entire period was that it had destabilized Afghanistan not simply as a pawn of, not simply as a consequence of fighting the Soviet Union, but that was what the cost of fighting the Soviet Union was, that an entire country, millions of people, suffered tremendously, that they were treated as tools by the United States, that their aspirations, their desires for freedom, their desires for security ultimately didn't matter to the United States, much as they didn't matter to the Soviet Union. And in the chaos that resulted, the Taliban took power, they sheltered Osama bin Laden, but they weren't the same thing as al-Qaeda. And the United States, after 9/11, decided that there was no relevant distinction between al-Qaeda, between the Taliban, and between what it called terrorist groups of global reach, which ultimately washes out to saying that while the respectable version of the Bush administration's policies were already an extremely expansive conception of who could be targeted, moving from terror groups like al-Qaeda to ultimately entire regimes. The Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz spoke in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 about ending states. But in the broader political, journalistic, and then popular conception, the enemy could be all of Islam. or it could be something just short of all of Islam. And from there, it was an extremely short, rather immediate transition to fearing American Muslims, fearing your neighbors, thinking your neighbors posed a threat to you, not that this apparatus of war and repression posed a threat to you.
You know, Spencer, one of the things that hasn't gotten reported very much is that as the Taliban seized control in these last weeks of Afghanistan, a key person that they executed, he was imprisoned and they executed him, was Abu Omar Khorasani, the former head of the Islamic State in South Asia. The significance of this.
Yeah, this is an extreme complication that has come up in the last couple years of particularly U.S. Taliban negotiations, by which I mostly mean back-channel negotiations. I shouldn't say back-channel, to be a little bit more specific. They weren't authorized before they were authorized. It was somewhat of a freelance effort by a retired U.S. Army colonel named Chris Kalenda and a retired U.S. ambassador to Pakistan named Robin Rafel. What they discovered in their talks with Taliban figures in Doha was that the Taliban were rather concerned about the rising presence of a so-called Islamic State branch in Afghanistan, what called itself, or the U.S. also called it, ISIS Khorasan or IS Khorasan. Essentially, the Taliban feared a kind of next generation of extremist entity insurgency using Islamic justification inside Afghanistan. And with somewhat, I think it's fair to say, good reason, given the way that ISIS fought and displaced al-Qaeda, the organization and entity that it emerged out of as well. And so you even saw over the last couple years, there was some excellent reporting that Wesley Morgan has done, where the Taliban has even been the beneficiary of U.S. airstrikes on ISIS Khorasan to the point where it seemed like, you know, they never got as far as some kind of modus vivendi, where they said, you know what, we in fact have an enemy in common. But it was a dynamic that both the Taliban and the U.S. side, particularly the more pragmatic elements of the U.S. military, were attentive to, that the Taliban viewed ISIS not as the next, you know, so-called al-Qaeda entity to sponsor and permit a staging ground to attack either the United States or its allies or its interests or, you know, so on and so forth, but in fact, an enemy to be confronted, an enemy to be dominated, an enemy to be defeated. And when we hear all of the kind of loose talk about the necessity of returning to war in Afghanistan so it doesn't become a staging ground for further attacks on the United States, it's not quite sunk in yet, or it's not quite penetrated, it's not quite been grappled with. That the Taliban are showing, like, very early signs of seeing ISIS as a threat.
And again, they killed him. They executed him, took him out of a prison in Kabul on that final day, Sunday, as they took control of the country. Spencer Ackerman, talk about the role the U.S. war and occupation, the brutality of the U.S. airstrikes, the torture at Bagram, the night raids played in gaining new recruits for the Taliban.
The United States tends not to attribute its brutality to any of the circumstances that it comes to bemoan when they manifest in the world. And Afghanistan is certainly a tragic example of that. The fact that after 9/11, the United States, in its political and journalistic and intellectual elites, generally speaking, refused to accept that there was a direct and tragic and awful historic consequence of its destabilization of Afghanistan in the 1980s to the degree that Taliban facilitation of Osama bin Laden in the country helped the execution of the 9/11 plot, which it's important to note did not involve Afghans and was not staged from Afghanistan, nor was it even planned in Afghanistan. It was far more planned in Germany. Nevertheless, that was an early foreboding of what we would see over the next 20 years, not just in Afghanistan, but throughout the war on terror, a disconnection, an unwillingness to face that America's violent and imperial actions breed their own next generation of enemies. That was on display once the United States went back into Afghanistan. And throughout the Afghanistan war, even during periods where counterinsurgency campaigns, at least on paper, paid lip service to the idea that protecting Afghan lives and, property and so forth was going to ultimately be decisive in the war, it never acted that way. It never acted as if what the point of the war was the protection of Afghan lives. It more often acted in such a way that it did not draw distinctions between Afghan lives and Afghan enemies. And amongst the major reasons for this is not necessarily like a specific decision to target Afghan civilians, but an inability to understand the country, understand its dynamics, and understand the rather complicated relationships in many ways between people who fight for the Taliban and the Taliban itself, or people who aid the Taliban under threat to their own life or threat to their family, or simply seek to endure the war, as so many people throughout so many wars simply aspire to, simply by not taking action that harmed the Taliban because they understood the consequences that could that they could experience. Over time, all of these things strengthened the Taliban, made the Taliban seem like, once again, a viable alternative to the United States. And then on a different level, the United States's contribution, and not just the United States alone's contribution to the misery in Afghanistan, came through the corruption that it always blamed on the Afghans, but was a significant driver of itself. So-called development experts, development aid and development money poured into Afghanistan far beyond a consideration of what a devastated Afghan economy could in fact absorb. And some of this money was very deliberately flooded in from the CIA to pay off warlords to ensure that they would ultimately be responsive to American interests, which would often be violent interests, which would often be things like, as the Joint Special Operations Command would perform throughout the Afghanistan war, Army Special Forces in particular throughout the Afghanistan war, raids on people's houses suspected of being aiding or facilitating the Taliban. And again, the Taliban, not even al-Qaeda, not the thing that attacked the United States, certainly not the core of al-Qaeda that plotted, planned, and executed 9/11. The United States was now at an extended war with a one-time harborer ally of al-Qaeda, rather than the thing itself, responsible for all of Afghanistan, but never acting responsibly toward the Afghan people.
I want to go to January 2015. This is the Obama years. Two hostages, one American, one Italian man, were accidentally killed by a U.S. drone strike along the Afghan-Pakistani border. Here's then-President Obama later apologizing for the killings.
This morning, I want to express our grief and condolences to the families of two hostages. One American, Dr. Warren Weinstein, and an Italian, Giovanni Laporto, who were tragically killed in a U.S. counterterrorism operation. Since 9/11, our counterterrorism efforts have prevented terrorist attacks and saved innocent lives, both here in America and around the world. And that determination to protect innocent life only makes the loss of these two men especially painful for all of us.
So there you have President Obama apologizing. Spencer, you have spent a good amount of time in Afghanistan. You were embedded there, and then you also reported independently there. Can you talk about the significance of this moment?
This was a profound moment. This is the only time that the United States, particularly the president of the United States, has not only acknowledged drone strikes that killed civilians, but apologized for it. And the reason why it's such a significant moment in its singularity is both in the book and for an earlier series that I did for The Guardian in 2016, I interviewed people, Pakistanis and Yemenis principally, who were survivors of drone strikes or whose relatives were killed in drone strikes. And one of the stories I tell in Reign of Terror is from a young Pakistani man named Fahim Qureshi. Fahim Qureshi was 13 years old when Obama launched his first drone strike, and it blew up Fahim's compound where he lived with his family. And they were gathering for a celebration of one of his relatives who had just returned from a successful business trip to the United Arab Emirates. 40 days later, Fahim woke from his coma. He had burns over most of his body. He was missing an eye, and he had learned that most of his family's breadwinners had been killed in the strike, so that when he left the hospital, his responsibilities would immediately be providing for his family however it was that his mangled body would perform. And I talked to him about the difficulties he experienced throughout about 7 years. And among the things he discussed was that he had tried through Pakistani authorities and through the U.S. embassy to get some kind of acknowledgement that what had happened to him had in fact happened, and that it didn't just happen as an act of God. It happened as an act by the United States of America. And none of that ever came. What did come was a supply of blood money, essentially. A payoff, essentially, to say, like, okay, this is what will count for restitution, and your account is settled, and you're not going to get any public acknowledgement, let alone an apology. And I kept hearing when I interviewed people, not just Fahim, but other people whose lives were changed irrevocably by drone strikes, about how Obama had apologized when he had killed white people, and never when he had killed people like them, never when he had killed their loved ones, never when the consequences of his actions had left someone maimed, had left someone in a position where he had to give up his dream of being a chemist and work however he could in the hope that, as he had put it to me, some of his younger cousins and his brothers would be able to live happy and prosperous lives. And I asked him, what do you think of Barack Obama? And he said, if there's a list of tyrants somewhere, Barack Obama's name is on it because of his drone strikes.
Spencer Ackerman, we're going to break and then come back. Spencer is author of Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. He's a national security reporter who publishes the Forever Wars newsletter on Substack. When we come back, we're going to look at, what he calls the Reign of Terror. We're going to look also at the rise of right-wing extremism in the United States, what all under Trump and Biden, intelligence agencies call the major domestic terror threat, as Republican Congress members now say that their deep concern is a threat of foreign terrorists. Stay with us.
Like never before, I'm tired of being actionless.
generals and majors by XTC. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're spending the hour with Spencer Ackerman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning national security reporter, author of Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. Spencer, you begin your book with the prologue with Timothy McVeigh visiting the far-right paramilitary compound in Elohim City, Oklahoma, before what you call the prologue's chapter heading, the worst terrorist attack in American history. Talk about the connection you see between the rise of right-wing extremism in the United States and the so-called war on terror.
I thought it was extremely important to see the war on terror in its fullness, in its totality, and only then can we understand its implications. And I think the only way to really do that is to look at who were the exceptions to the war on terror, who the war on terror didn't target, despite fundamentally similar actions. And there we can understand not just what the war on terror is, but its relationship to American history, which shapes it so deeply. And so I also wanted to kind of start with a journalistic.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Hâte de voir son groupe préféré sur scène. Il y a pensé toute la semaine. Il a acheté son billet. Il a mis son chandail du groupe. Il s'est rendu à la salle de spectacle. Il n'a pas pu rentrer dans la salle de spectacle. Il a rangé son chandail du groupe. Il a acheté son billet. Et il y a pensé toute la semaine.
N'attendez pas de frapper un mur. Faites-vous vacciner. En septembre, le passeport vaccinal sera exigé pour fréquenter certains lieux publics. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros, bienvenidas y bienvenidos todos para esta nueva edición de Latin Music Mondays. El día de hoy tenemos un programa especial conmigo, Felipe Nadó, alias El Extravagante, con mucho, mucho gusto de poder compartir con todos ustedes este programa dedicado a Cosmovision Records, a nuestro último lanzamiento que se llama Cantos a la Madre, que yo como codirector del proyecto basado en Montreal, pero yo ahora hablando desde Francia, así que les mando un gran abrazo a toda la familia en Montreal. Bueno, estamos presentando este nuevo álbum llamado Cantos a la Madre, que está dedicado a las energías femeninas.